Hi there, welcome back to Hugo's There 2.0, and this time we are doing a Seth Picks kind of episode where this is a book that I wanted to cover, and I was fortunate enough to have a guest volunteer to cover it, and the title is Alas Babylon by Pat Frank, and my guest is Mitch Wagner, a returning guest from the deep past. Hi there, Mitch.
Hi, Seth. It's good to be back and to see and talk to you again.
Yeah, it was 2018 when you were last on, so episode, I don't know, 13 or something. I gotta know now.
Something like that. Yeah. But I've been a devoted listener since then.
Yeah, it was 13. So yeah, five plus years. So anything changed with you in that time?
Well, I'm now doing more content marketing professionally. So writing articles for vendors on websites about why people should use their products. These are business-to-business technology products, so a lot of your readers or listeners probably would not have even heard of them. I'm still doing a little tech journalism, too, of the business-to-business ilk. Other than that, we're all doing fine here, San Diego.
Excellent. And then you also have a Facebook group where you post interesting stuff, and that's very entertaining.
Yeah, I do kind of old-school like blogging on Facebook. So a lot of link blogging and post a lot of memes and vintage photos. And I actually do it on a whole bunch of different social media platforms. I've, as a holdover from my tech journalism days, when you've got to promote yourself, I'm spread a little thin.
Yeah. Understood. So Alas Babylon. So one thing that I want to do with these, I can't even remember what the year of the novel is. 1959. Okay. And Pat Frank, who is not an author that I was familiar with prior to finding this book. And the way I found it was my wife recommended it to me because she had read it in high school. And I don't remember when that was. It was probably 15 years ago when I first read the book and really enjoyed it. And then I've reread it a couple times over the years. And I thought, oh, this would be fun to talk about because I feel like it's a novel that I don't really hear mentioned all that often. Unless if you're in a science fiction book club or something, and somebody says, hey, what are some good post-apocalyptic novels? Somebody will always bring this one up. But it's not as well known as something like 1984 or, you know, other things that people read in high school. And so I wanted to kind of talk about that as sort of an underseen novel. But I did want to ask you, Mitch, you know, what attracted you to covering this book?
Well, kind of similar experience to your wife. I read it in junior high school. I think they call it middle school nowadays. So I was 12 or 13 years old. It was actually assigned, and it was possibly the only book that I was assigned in school that I really fell in love with and just read it and reread it about a million times when I was a teenager. One of many books I reread a million times when I was a teenager. And then I kind of stopped rereading things very much, and my whole adulthood passed. So this is almost 50 years. I don't know, it was 72 or 73 when I encountered it when I was that age. And then I picked it up again during the pandemic for two reasons. One is kind of obvious. Like, it was 2020. The world was coming apart. So let's read a book about the world coming apart.
Yes.
And the other one was something that's always intrigued me. It's a statement by Cory Doctorow that in real life, people tend to come together during emergencies. As a science fiction fan, if you imagine what would it be like if the civilization fell, you'd imagine your neighbor would be at your throat and there'd be ravening mobs and hordes of people coming down your street and looters. Whereas in reality, people tend to come together. You know, think about your own life. Your neighbor's probably a pretty nice guy and would help you out if you were in trouble, and you would help them. Yeah. And that is very much a theme of Alas Babylon.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting that, you know, like my wife read it during the Cold War. You obviously read it during the Cold War. I only came to this book well after the Cold War was over, but I can easily put myself back in that mindset just because growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, that was a fact of everyday life, that nuclear war was always possible. And of course, we like to think we're out of the woods now, and that's optimistic.
Yeah. It's not one of the disasters we worry about.
No, probably still should, but it's not at the forefront the way it was then.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So just really quick, the premise of this novel, in case anyone is coming to this and has never heard of Pat Frank, has never heard of Alas Babylon, the premise of it is there's a nuclear exchange with the USSR. And the book is set in Fort Repose, Florida, which I believe is fictional, but it's in proximity to Jacksonville and Orlando and Miami, major centers that were hit. And so, you know, power ends up getting knocked out. Most of the infrastructure is sort of still undamaged, but no power, you know, no infrastructure in a lot of ways. And so things go a bit sideways. And then, like Mitch said, people in the town try to come together and survive in the post-apocalyptic world. And so you have raiders, you have radiation, you have food shortages. So that's what it's about. It's a survival novel in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. It's much more about people. Interestingly, it's much more about people learning to live with shortages.
Yes.
Than it is about people learning to live with violence.
Yeah.
Yeah. If there's one or two scenes of raiders and
yeah, violence. Yeah. It's a long way into the novel before you get to that.
Yeah. Yeah. But by and large, it's, just people, you know, everything from medical supplies, insulin, at least, I don't know how it is now, but insulin, at least in that time, requires refrigeration. So if you have no electricity, you're out. They don't have coffee. They don't have everything. They don't have cigarettes because it's 1959 and everybody smokes. They don't have razors. You know, they don't even have salt. At one point, that becomes a big issue.
Yes. Yeah. I wanted to start with some of the kind of common DNA between Alas, Babylon and other fiction. There was a show in the, I think, early 2000s called Jericho, which is very, very similar. And it's one of those things where I feel like it's not quite an adaptation, but it's very much in the spirit of, because it's the essential premise is the same, but it's set in Kansas instead of Florida. I think a little less is known about the state of the war than there is in Alas, Babylon, which is something that I didn't remember from my previous readings of the book. I didn't remember that you knew quite as much as you did about the military side of things, about the actual geopolitics of it. But yeah, you can, I've often thought Jericho is sort of a sideways adaptation of Alas, Babylon, but I never saw that there was any explicit reference to it.
Yeah. I mean, I never saw Jericho. So I don't remember it. It surprised me. I mean, so like I said, I read it in 2020 and then I read it again for you. I listened to the audiobook, which was a great experience, by the way. Highly recommend.
The Will Patton one?
Yeah.
He did a nice job.
Will Patton, well-known character actor in science fiction. Most recently well-known, he played like a deputy sheriff or something on Silo.
Yeah.
Possibly most recently well-known, but he's all over. If you look him up on IMDb, you're like, oh yeah, I saw him in that. Mm-hmm. Always good.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it surprised me on this last listening, how much of like half of the first third of the book is basically a techno thriller from 1959.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just all these told from the point of view of the hero's brother, Mark Bragg, who is an Air Force officer in intelligence and dealing with this war that's escalating. And we're even in an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean and a pilot at one point.
The spark that starts everything, right? Where he goes further than he should go and something goes wrong and then everything kicks off. But I mean, it very much does put you back in the mindset of at periods during the Cold War, at least from my perspective, I thought, wow, this any moment things could go bad, you know? And there's so much fiction that revolves around that. Things like Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe. Which are those things where you're like, just one little thing has to go wrong. And then all of a sudden, essentially the entire world is screwed. You know, that brings to mind something like On the Beach where, even in the aftermath of it, do we really know what was the cause? Does it matter?
No. Yeah. There's, look, you want to, I know the structure that you usually do. Do you want to give the, a little bit more on the no spoiler overview and then jump into the spoiler stuff?
Yeah. Let's do that.
So yeah, the no spoiler overview is where we're very much in this town of Fort Repose, Florida, population something like 3,500. And the author who we really should talk about at some point, Pat Frank, knows this territory very well. It's a small town, essentially in the deep south. It's the part of Florida that's very Dixie. And we see the banker and we see the manager of the grocery store. And our main character is a man named Randy Bragg. I think his full name is Randolph Frazee Bragg or something like that.
Yeah.
Very good Southern name. He's this kind of 30-ish bachelor playboy who lives in this great house that he inherited down in his family. And he's
technically an attorney, right?
Yeah. He's basically, he's got a trust fund he lives on. He does part-time lawyering. He day drinks. Yes. he's kind of a playboy man about town in this little town. And his brother is an Air Force officer who gives him a warning from a biblical phrase that is important to a childhood incident of theirs, "Alas, Babylon." It's a code phrase that means that the nuclear war is imminent. And so he runs to the supermarket and other stores and stocks up on a whole bunch of supplies. And Mark Bragg, the brother, sends his wife and two children to stay with Randy. And then the nuclear bomb drops. And we're just in this little community just trying to survive day to day.
Yeah. The fascinating thing is, like, the thing that I didn't remember was that, as I mentioned, the reader knows more about what's going on in the world than, of course, the characters do. But mm-hmm. I didn't remember that we even knew that much about it. I remember thinking, okay, Mark is the grown-up. Randy is kind of arrested development.
He's the man baby, you know?
yeah, very much. And so it gives him a nice arc, though, right? Because he has to all of a sudden take responsibilities mm-hmm. thrust on him. And I like the way he goes about it, too. And I want to talk about this more in spoilers, the way he kind of assembles a community in the ways that some of the other people in the Dixie South would not because of the times.
Yeah. Yeah. The one other thing I would say before jumping into spoilers, Randy is a character. There's an expression I've heard in another context of another story entirely called perfect and perfectly flawed. Mm. So I've made him sound like a little bit more of an obnoxious frat boy than he actually is in the novel. He's just this kind of lost guy. He drinks too much, but he's otherwise a really good guy. And you feel like he's got a lot of potential if he just pull it together.
Definitely.
Yeah. His emotional arc is that's what he does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had written down that I had remembered that he was more of a ne'er-do-well. And really, I think that's just the perspective of some of the, like, there's the lady who lives near him who is just certain that he's spying on her, and watching her run around in her, or watching her, walk around in her skivvies or something.
It turns
out he's just bird watching.
Yeah. There's the whole, thing. The first chapter I read, here's a wild comparison here. I read Snow Crash, Neal Stephenson novel. And I tried to read it a couple of times, and I hated the first chapter. I couldn't get past the first chapter. Hmm. And I mentioned it to a friend who loved it. He said, oh, yeah, the first chapter is terrible. You just got to push through it. And I did, and I loved it. I would say for anybody born after 1990, the first chapter of The Last Babylon is probably like that. It says the character that we're seeing in that is named Florence. I think Florence Wycheck. And she's a very, very 1959 era spinster.
Right.
She lives alone with her cat and her goldfish, and she watches the morning show every day, and she's convinced the neighbor is spying on her, and she's just fat, and no man would ever want her because she's really old. She's in her 40s. And right. I just laughed when I reread it recently. And then when I was reading it again for you, I was like, you know, I think anybody in their 30s now is going to pick this book up and just throw it across the room at that point. Enjoy it if you can. Push through it if you can't. It gets a lot better.
It's worth mentioning too. This is a book written in the 50s, set in the South, and so some of the phraseology is not woke, right? The N-word is employed by some of the characters. You know, the narrator is not, you know, the Pat Frank is not using that word, and Randy isn't that way, right? But there's a lot of racism in that time, in that area, right? This is pre-civil rights.
Yeah. So I would, you know, it's before the March on Washington. It's before everything. I would describe the perspective as progressive for its time.
Right. Vintage woke. That's the term that
I guess you could say that. Yeah. A couple of characters drop N-bombs. There was one sequence, there's a black family. That's part the Henrys, of the core group he forms, and they're very valuable. They have skills that are useful. There's one scene where Randy is bringing a young black man from that family into his office and trying to warn him that the war is coming. The guy's name is Malachi, and he says, "Now, Malachi, you may the war is coming." And Malachi says, "Oh yeah, I'm aware of that. I could see the situation is heating up in the Mediterranean and the Russia." And Randy is like, "What?" And he's like, "Yeah, I do housework for you, and I do housework for this other character, and I keep all your newspapers and magazines and read them." Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the two sides of it. It's a progressive view of a racist society that the characters all take for granted.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Pat Frank before we move on, because this is, well, until yesterday, it was the only one of his novels that I've read. I picked up a copy of Mr. Adam, which is very similar to Children of Men. The idea is, you know, all the men are sterilized except for one guy. It didn't grab me as much as The Last Babylon did, I have to say. But he wrote some other techno thrillers that look interesting. Like there's one called Forbidden Area. I wanted to ask, have you read any other Pat Frank?
I have not read any other Pat Frank at all.
Okay.
It was only in 2020 when I was kind of spelunking about this novel a bit that I even knew anything about him other than the name. Did you look into anything about him?
Not too much. Just a little bio in the back of the book. So if you have any facts about him, you want to.
Oh yeah. There was an very interesting, article about the novel and about the author that ran relatively recently in one of the Florida papers that of course was available on the internet. He was really a character. He was a journalist, World War II correspondent, confidant. I think he did speech writing for JFK. He was a part-time novelist. He was the highest of highest possible high functioning alcoholics. So he basically died of, you know, his whole body breaking down under the onslaught of drinking in shortly after this novel came out in 1964. I believe he was only in his 50s. And people remember, everybody around him who survived him, his family remembers him as this very charming man, always surrounded by women, young women. He loved women and women loved him, according to what somebody said. made and lost several fortunes. One of these people who might, you know, show up living in a mansion and driving a Cadillac, or show up completely penniless and surfing on your couch, and you never know which was which. So quite a character. And he seemed to, in fiction and novels, he seemed to specialize in his genre, which quite frankly, I didn't even know existed, of kind of like nuclear war techno thrillers. I mean, I was familiar with techno thrillers from Tom Clancy and other authors like that, but apparently there was a whole genre of just focused on nuclear war, and he was specialized in that.
Yeah, and he's substantially earlier than Clancy and I can't think of any of the other names of techno thriller. I mean, even Crichton, right? But those are more science fiction.
Yeah. Crichton isn't doing a lot of that Cold War stuff.
Right. And I think the fact that he was close to, you know, he had government sources. I think he even worked in propaganda at some point, where, you know, he knew enough about kind of the geopolitics of the Cold War to really write a very convincing beginning to this war. And that was something I really enjoyed this time, just seeing how well he laid it out.
Yeah. And he seemed to know a lot, at least for that particular section of the novel. He seemed to know a lot about, you know, the weapons and the ships, like any good techno thriller writer does. I should point out for anybody thinking about reading it, that section is not really, it's not the strength. It's fine, but it's not the strength of the book.
Yeah. It's certainly not. It's not what I remembered from the first couple of times I read it. And so reading it this time, I thought, oh, okay, there's more of this than I thought. But you're right. It's the strength of it is in the characters and the survival.
Yeah. And there's this cliche that I never really liked, but I never found a better way to say it. You know, like the location is the character. But they'll say that about movies set in New York or something like that. And this was very much this small town in Florida is I'm doing air quotes that people won't see, a character. It's a big part, just evoking this community and its 100 years of history and how people live there.
I said we just go ahead and go over into spoilers and talk about whatever we want to talk about. You mentioned the code word, right? Alas, Babylon was, and you also talked about the Southern liberal almost, right? Who is more progressive than the folks around him, where their family is friendly with the family just across the way from them, the Henrys, who are a black family. And Randy had grown up with Malachi, right? Just like playmates as friends. And so as adults, yes, Malachi works for him, but they're also friends. There's a power dynamic there, right? Where when everything kind of goes bad and he tells Malachi about it, he essentially hands him a bunch of cash and says, you know, go buy stuff and don't worry about it.
Yeah. I mean, Randy himself, without having the language to say it, is the language of 2023 here. He's aware that there's barriers of both race and class between him and Malachi. At one point, he thinks about, so this guy's a Korean War veteran because it's 1959 and he's in his 20s or 30s. And he's commenting that there was a black officer in the Korean War that he was friends with. And he's wondering why he has not been able to maintain a friendship with Malachi into adulthood.
Yeah.
And he thinks as well, it's because Malachi is a handyman and I'm a lawyer. It is, you know, they keep coming back to it. It is a progressive view of a racist society, but a sympathetic view of that society. So,
yeah. And it's not like it's without its faults, right? And you know, there's a character, I can't remember if it's Malachi's brother or just somebody else in the Henry extended family that they call Two-Tone. Mm-hmm. And he's the loser, right? Although he does end up having his value.
Yeah, he's off on the, I mean, this is something that, oh boy, when I was doing like getting into an internet deep dive here and just following link after link after link, I found a reference to an academic paper that was written in 2007 called Extraordinarily Convenient Neighbors, African American Characters in White Authored Post-Atomic Novels.
Interesting.
And I think I only got to read their abstract, but her point is that the characters exist basically to illuminate or educate the white people. And I was thinking about that. I was going, this is interesting because one of the characteristics of this novel that I really like is we jump from one viewpoint to another. Mm-hmm. You know, we're inside Randy's head most of the time, but then we're in his girlfriend's head and then we're in the neighbor's head, but we're barely ever in any of the black characters' heads at all. We don't see what they're going through.
Yeah.
True. So I thought that was an interesting point. Doesn't diminish enjoyment or quality of the novel. But it was an interesting point. But I think Two-Tone also evolves. He's kind of off stage and you don't really see it that much, but he becomes a valuable and contributing member of the community.
Yeah. And it's an interesting window too into the upbringing of Randy and Mark that they have this reference that's from Preacher Henry's sermons. So they were churched in some way. And essentially, it looks like they at least looked in on the black church, right? Because that's one of the contradictions of American Christianity is that there's a black church and a white church even to this day.
Yeah, and one of the neighbor characters is Preacher Henry, who's an older man who is the preacher at this black church.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things I would compare this book to, interestingly, is Stephen King. Mm. I started thinking about that a lot. Both of them. Regional authors writing about rural people in small towns, writing with really real love for the communities, and with this fantastic ability to draw character. Mm-hmm. Even a character who only appears in a couple of pages and never shows up again will be fully and completely drawn.
So one of the interesting things is in an apocalypse, older ways of, you know, keeping records and older technology, old forms of keeping knowledge outlast the apocalypse, right? And so old books and journals are really handy. And there's people who have those technologies or have that knowledge become important. And so the banker becomes very unimportant to the point that he commits suicide because he realizes, you know, that, oh, this is over. What I've built here is, it doesn't mean anything. And you have that great moment from, I think it was the grocer after everybody came and did a run on the shops and bought everything he had. He said, well, all I have left is cash. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what good is cash now?
Yeah.
Whereas like the admiral, who's a retiree, he's settled in the area and he's always checking the shortwave. And he has all these old journals going back decades and decades. And he becomes, you know, he might be like, people think, oh, he's the weird hermit, you know, who lives on the river. You know, don't talk to the guy, he's weird. Well, he becomes very, very important in this post-apocalypse because he has that shortwave radio, which they can keep active for part of the day by using car batteries.
Yeah, that's another thing that he has in common with King, which is that a lot of his characters are very mechanically proficient.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a guy who can't drive a nail, so I'm not the best judge of this, but it all seems very real. It all seems very real to me. So they know how to rig up a still to make alcohol for trade goods, and they know how to wire a car battery. They know how to redirect the plumbing.
And that's one of the really important things early on is that the Henrys have an artesian well, and you know, the water doesn't smell great. It smells a little sulfurous, but it runs. And so that's really, really important.
Yeah, it becomes their water supply. And the Henrys also know how to fish.
Yes.
So, or at least are far, far better at it than the white people.
Mm-hmm. Talking about being mechanically inclined, I always say when there's a project, I'm like, I can lift stuff. though I've found in recent days, and as I've been trying to teach my son how to fix stuff around the house, it's the kind of stuff where as a homeowner, you just eventually learn how to fix something because it's there. And I told him it's easier than when I was a kid, right? When I was a kid, you just kind of had to know how to fix stuff. If you didn't know how to fix stuff, then you went, you called the handyman, where now you can just go onto YouTube and find somebody who's replaced that part on your car or that latch in your door or something. And you can find that and I don't have the instinct for it, but I can follow somebody's instructions.
Yeah. My wife knows how to do that stuff. So we're in a gender reversed family here. She just
excellent.
Like, honey, this thing is broken.
So one reference that I thought of when I was reading this book was at some point you find out that Josephine Van Brooker Brown, the former mm-hmm. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, which I think now is more like Health and Human Services, is elevated to the presidency, right? And that mm-hmm. reminded me of Battlestar Galactica, where the President Roslin was the Secretary of Education, I believe. But it also reminded me of, have you ever seen the movie The Bed Sitting Room?
No. Never heard that one.
Maybe 1970, mm-hmm. maybe earlier. It was one of the ones that was nominated for the Hugo Award. It's an English film. It's absurd. But at some point they're singing God Save the Queen. But instead of God Saving the Queen, it's God Save Miss Ethel Schroke of 393A High Street, Leytonstone. Because she is down the line of succession in this post-apocalypse, this random lady.
Well, since we're off on a tangent here, have you ever seen the movie King Ralph?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Goodman. So,
John Goodman is a sleazy bottom tier to Las Vegas lounge singer. And there's a tragic accident involving a group photo of the royal family where the entire royal family is killed. And he turns out to be the next in the line of succession.
That was actually a fun movie. I saw that one in the theater.
Yeah, I think I saw it on cable soon after it came out. It was it was enjoyable. It was fun. The description sounds like something you'd like, then you'd like it.
Yeah.
So
I did like, so talking more about the kind of race politics of this, the author points out in his authorial voice that the color barrier is kind of removed in large part by the apocalypse because the white only and colored only water fountains no longer function.
Yeah, it's removed, but is it?
Not totally. Yeah.
I mean, I noticed there's this one scene where after they've gotten things together a few days after the nuclear war, after they've got their feet under them, they have all this meat that he foolishly put in the freezer. And it starts going bad. So they say, we'll just have a steak party. And then they're all sitting around afterwards. And the narrator comments that all the blacks are sitting in the edge of the room.
Mm.
Like it's just the way everything gravitates. I think one of the things that I really like about Pat Frank as an author is I have this theory that there are authors with kind of journalistic eyes who see things in their characters based on their observation of real life that they themselves might not even be entirely aware of.
Mm.
So I think that's one of the, I think Randy Bragg and Pat Frank maybe think they're more progressive than they really are.
Very likely.
Yeah. It should be said that, yeah.
Yeah, when you're comparing yourself to the out and out racists, pat yourself on the back for being not quite as racist.
Yeah. And there's one character, the character of the father-in-law. I say father-in-law, but they're only married. Randy's girlfriend's father.
Lib's father.
Who owns a successful, who owns a successful either building contract or a manufacturing business before the war. And is retired early and he's very full of himself. And he lets us with this kind of like racist rant that has my jaw dropping before the nuclear war. And mm-hmm. actually, I think he uses a couple of racial epithets that I had never even heard. Mm-hmm. And by the end of it, he's like working side by side with this black character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting that that's kind of, I think it was good in the sense of this being a very great rant, Pat Frank being a great observer of humanity. That's kind of how redemption works in real life.
Yeah.
In B fiction, people make speeches and they go to the black guy. I was a racist. I'm sorry. I love you now. Let's hug. And in reality, it's just like people just stop being racist or stop doing whatever bad thing they did was.
Yeah. Yeah, they eventually questioned whatever assumptions that they, I mean, they were taught racism, right? That's the way it works.
Yeah.
And eventually, and that's one of the things with, you know, cancel culture, if you want to use that term, where somebody might be a racist, and shouldn't we hope that they will stop, you know, that they'll learn and they'll be better? And shouldn't we hope for that for them? And then when, if they make those changes, you know, can we not welcome some of those people back?
Yeah. Hey, don't get me started on cancel culture. I don't think it exists. I think it's nonsense. I think there's just consequences for what people say.
No, I totally agree. But there is a tendency, I think, to just shove people off and say, no, there are certain categories of, like, I see this happen in sports fandom where somebody will be accused of domestic violence. And there's a section of the fans who are like, well, so do we never forgive this guy? I'm like, no, we never forgive this guy. we never reward him with being able to make his living doing that thing, public thing, because of this other thing that he did. Yeah, that's, he can redeem himself privately and then stay gone away.
Yeah, Eddie Murphy, on the other hand, did some incredibly racist stuff in his early routines. Or not racist, homophobic stuff in his early routines.
Yeah, very much.
And his statement now is like, I don't think he's even apologized for it. He's just said, I would not do that today. That was wrong. Right. You know what? 1984 or whatever, I was watching that stuff and laughing my ass off.
Sure. Yeah.
Despite the fact that one of my closest friends was gay, unknown to me at that time. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you look back on that stuff and you're like, well, I regret that I was not a safe person at that time for somebody to come out to.
There was, there's one section of the novel that I really like, and I dove into Goodreads on this too, and someone was saying, well, this is incredibly sexist. I'm like, is it though? There's one section that the men go off on this excursion, and the women are at home. And when the men come, and they're all worried the men have died. I think they're delayed or something like that. And when they come back home, the women are so distraught with relief that they start crying. And Randy is saying, well, women just need men. That just shows that. And I'm thinking, does it though? They did fine with the men gone.
They had written you off for dead. They were grateful that you were back. And it's okay to be emotional about that.
They got emotional about it when there was time to be emotional. So I think that the narrator understands these things even when Randy doesn't.
That was when they were going looking for salt, wasn't it?
I believe so. Yeah. Which is a really great section.
It really is great. Yeah. I like that a lot.
Yeah. One of the themes of this novel is, you know, how we, it's kind of a love letter to civilization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this idea that we can all take, so we don't even think about so many things like having salt.
Yeah. One thing that cracked me up was when I can't remember what Mark's daughter's name was, but she steals a goldfish to use as bait to catch a big fish, a big catfish, I think, or a bass or something. And of course the cat takes the blame.
Yeah. That was pretty good. Yeah. The whole thing. And she becomes the big hero because she finds a box in the attic that has a wind up gramophone and a straight razor. For the men. Mm-hmm. The doctor, the other thing taken for granted, one of the doctors, they have one doctor and his glasses break.
Yeah.
Or are smashed by marauders, and that's kind of it. So now he needs someone to show him things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at some of my notes I made. One of the things that seems interesting to me as a 2023 reader, who's grown up, like, I don't care what your politics are now. I think you're pretty much mistrustful of institutions and government now.
Yeah.
And Pat Frank doesn't have that problem. You know,
no.
In this novel, the military has executed the biggest bungle in the history of the military. Mm-hmm. The military in this novel, I keep saying in this novel because I don't want military listeners to get on my case about this. In this novel, the military has utterly failed in its one job to protect the United States. And yet Pat Frank is still reverent toward them throughout and is relieved. And the characters are relieved when they find the military chain of command still exists.
Right. Because then Randy ends up essentially being not recommissioned, but, you know, he's the new Miss Van Brucker Brown. Conscripts essentially, like, reactivates any reservists.
Yeah, any reservists are now officers. Randy, as a veteran, is a reservist. Therefore, he is essentially the military dictator of this town. But that's a happy ending. That's good.
Yeah.
it's just there. I remember when I was a kid reading about the real life succession plan that existed following the nuclear war. You know, if there was a catastrophic nuclear war, all the president and all the Congress would be in bunkers. And then the post office would be activated for this and that and be able to command the people. And I remember as a kid thinking relieved that the government would survive that situation. And then when I found it again as an adult, I was like, no, if that happens, forget it. The government failed. Goodbye.
Yeah. Yeah. Talking about the civilization part of it, you know, Randy is not a religious man, but once they start kind of getting things back together and then they're going to have Easter services, he finds himself excited by that, even though he's not a churchgoer, but he sees that as kind of a civilization surviving thing.
Yeah. One thing that I as a non-religious person have only come to realize recently, relatively recently, within the last 10 or 20 years or so, is that the extent to which religion is also community for so many people.
Yeah. Big time.
And it's also in particularly in this, this is the edge. This is the trans 1959 is the transition when you, no, it's not. I'm thinking out loud and I'm crazy, but still, you know, in the time before television and before radio and even before recorded music, church was your entertainment too.
Yeah. I mean, definitely Randy and Mark found Preacher Henry's services entertaining, right? Otherwise they wouldn't have had that code word, Alas Babylon.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the opportunity, a black friend took me to her church a number of years ago. It was a Southern Baptist church located on Long Island. How's that for weird? There's a whole history for that. And they had a choir-a-thon.
Oh, yeah.
It was wonderful. It was amazing. Entertainment and religion blur. And this was in the church service is an opportunity for the whole community to get dressed up and get together and just be together.
And I can't remember if Randy's thinking this or if Pat Frank is editorializing and saying if man retained faith in God, he might also retain faith in man, meaning, you know, faith that civilization can come back from this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's probably Randy thinking it.
Yeah. So there's a subplot that recurs a couple times where Randy has a former girlfriend, Rita, who she doesn't quite think that they're done, but he's like, no, we are. And her brother's kind of a ne'er-do-well as well. And an interesting thing happens with them. And I haven't looked up to what extent this is actually a thing. They've essentially looted jewelry from some stores and it's radioactive. And
yeah. When I mentioned rereading this novel a few years ago to friends who had read it, they all remembered that very vividly. It's radioactive jewelry. The jewelry has become radioactive and everybody who hoards it dies.
Yeah.
A horrible, horrible death from radiation poisoning. And it's very, very, it's very biblical, really.
Yeah. Yeah. The other day I was out in our garage lifting kettlebells and it left this sort of ashy marks on my fingers. And it reminded me of that where I think she took off a ring that she was wearing and there was a dark band under where the ring was.
And when we see her again a few weeks later, she's very much, you know, before that she thinks, you know, when we first encounter her, she has hoarded all this stuff. She's got televisions. She's got all this jewelry. She's got everything you could possibly want. And she says, when civilization comes back in a few weeks or a couple of months, we're going to be rich because we'll have all this stuff. and then a few weeks later, we see her again and she is chastened and she holds up her hand and she's got this scar on her ring finger. And she says, I am married to the bomb now.
Yeah, that's pretty dark.
Yeah.
I think the darkest thing in the novel, though, is I looked it up. It's Peyton is the niece, the daughter of Mark. When someone catches her saying, if I grow up. Not when I grow up. And that's very, like, as a father, I'm just like, that's very sad.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is. It sure is. I was really moved. I'm not a parent, but I was very moved by the brother, Mark Bragg, the colonel, just saying goodbye to his family and knowing he's thinking he's never going to see them again.
No, you don't have to be a parent to think that would be terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. He's sending them away to safety.
Yeah. And his wife is hung, her name's Helen. She's hung up on, did my husband survive? Cause he was at Strategic Air Command. And so at some point, you know that she loves Dan, the doctor, and he loves her and they want to be together. But she, as long as she doesn't know that Mark has passed, she can't really let herself
marry
Dan.
I don't know if we ever find out for sure, or if he just kind of...
We get a pretty good idea at the very end.
Yeah, yeah.
There is an interesting, you know, you had mentioned earlier that Dan gets hit by raiders, marauders. And this is where the president says, you know, protect yourselves, set up the ability to protect yourself. And Randy forms essentially a militia, right? Going back to early Constitution days, right?
Yeah.
And they set out to get justice, right? And I like that. I think it was Lib who actually had the idea to form what they called Q-ships, where it's a, they take a, like an old grocery truck or something.
And a panel truck.
Yeah. And they turn it into a Trojan horse kind of thing almost, where they have soldiers inside.
Yep. Yep.
And they're setting it up for the raiders to try to rob. And there was an interesting thing about the race politics, right? Where Malachi realizes they'll be more likely to attack this if it's a black driver.
Yep. Randy initially wants to drive and he wants to be in uniform.
Yeah.
When he does it, to emphasize that it's an official government action. And Malachi is the black guy, is the one who convinces him that, A, that's a bonehead idea because they'll see the uniform. And Randy's like, no, they won't. And Malachi's like, yes, they will.
Yeah.
And also, if they see a white guy driving, they'll be alert. If they see a black guy, we'll have loosely paraphrased, we'll have racism working in our favor, he says.
Right. Yeah. They'll underestimate it based on that.
Yeah. And he, again, since we're in the spoiler warning area, I will tell you that he is killed in the raid, which is kind of a black friend introduced me years ago to the cliche, well known in the black community, the black guy dies.
Yes.
if there is,
he's hardly alone in this novel, but
no. But if you're the pure form, if you're watching like an action or science fiction movie with five characters in it, one of them is black, the black guy isn't making it. The other four will make it to the end of the movie, but not him.
Best reference to that is in the movie Evolution with Orlando Jones and David Duchovny. And at some point, David Duchovny tells Orlando Jones, hey, you know, grab that thing. He's like, no, I've seen this movie. The black dude dies first.
Yeah, there was a show, I can't remember the name of it. It was very bland name, but it was basically about time travel. And the physicist who invents the time travel is a black guy in his 20s or 30s. Black nerd, and the other characters want him to come in the time ship with them because he's the only one who knows how to drive it. And he's like, no, there is nowhere in the past that is good for a person who looks like me. Yeah, but the guy, you know, the guy dies a hero. Mm-hmm. He was attacked. He tactically saw things nobody else did, and he was a hero. Yeah. And he's given a hero's funeral in this little community. So,
Well, and then the highwaymen are all killed except for one who they bring back and hang. And
you
could spin off into an interesting discussion on capital punishment, because you'd think in the post-apocalypse you'd want to preserve life as much as possible.
Yeah.
But it's also a fairly easy argument that men like this would always be a danger. There's some interesting stuff that actually happened on The Walking Dead in this regard, but that I won't spoil. Just the fate of Negan is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's ever said in A Last Babylon, but there is a sense that like these guys don't have the luxury of having jails or having people to guard jails. And also this guy's a murderer. He's horrible. So maybe forbearing capital punishment is something that is a luxury they can't afford in the world of this novel.
Yeah. You can't sentence somebody to transportation, right? You can't send them to Australia. Mm-mm. Yeah, in the wake of that, right? That's when they kind of form the small army to defend Fort Repose. And everything's going well until they start running short of salt, and that's a major problem.
And they find this old historical record.
Yeah,
old journal from the Civil War era. In the town found salt.
Yep.
So they go out and find tons of salt. They also start running out of food because the fish aren't biting.
They find out that armadillos are edible.
Yeah. Yeah, and Preacher Henry, the old black guy, is the one guy who knows how to catch fish when they're not biting in the shore. Mm-hmm. And it's a great sequence with the little girl, Peyton, talking to him. Like, why didn't you say anything? Well, nobody asked me, says the Preacher Henry.
Right. Yeah, that was good. Peyton was the one who went and talked to him.
Yeah, and figured it out.
You know, toward the end of the novel, they start to see choppers flying over, and they realize, okay, there's some remnant of the government still up and running. And I haven't thought that much about it, but thinking about what you said earlier about people being suspicious of the government nowadays, I don't think it would take that many months of your town being isolated and out of communications, especially today, for any official kind of presence to be very comforting.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Especially today we're so much more connected, right?
Especially if you're running out of gas, so the cars don't work anymore. And these guys fly in a helicopter. And also they say, you know, what do you need? And the people in the town are very self-sufficient. And one pipes up and says, well, our one doctor, his glasses are broken, so we can use new glasses. And the military commanding officer says, oh yeah, we can do that. So,
yeah. I think I'm not sure how much Pat Frank understood about fallout and that kind of stuff. He does talk a little bit about, you know, the way the winds blow and how Fort Repose just ended up being in essentially kind of the eye of the hurricane, where it didn't really get hit by fallout in any way other than stuff that was brought in like jewelry and other metals. So I'm not totally sure how, it's not exactly hard science fiction.
I don't know that much about it myself. Possibly everything I think I know might come from this novel. So
it might be more optimistic than is warranted.
There are contaminated areas in the world of this, in the United States of this novel. Florida is one of them, but this happens to be a little island of uncontaminated.
So yeah, the chopper shows up, and of course Randy knows one of the guys in it, just because through Mark, I think, he knows folks in the military. And the guy gives an overview of what's left of the country, but he does say that Omaha, which is where Strategic Air Command was, is definitely gone. It's one of the totally destroyed cities, and it'll be centuries in rebuilding due to radiation. That kind of gives Helen the answer, right? Even if he survived, nobody can get there for a really long time.
Yeah.
Probably our lifetimes. But I do also like somebody asks, you know, well, hey, did we win?
Yeah, that's
the guy
big
says,
one.
Oh yeah, yeah, we beat their pants off. Not that it matters.
Yeah, that's a big one. It comes on. That was a big deal when I was in school.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That I remember having discussions in history class and other times. I remember one of my classmates saying, if we went to war with Russia, we'd kick their butt, you know. And my teacher said, yeah, but what would that look like? You know, here we live in a city in Anchorage that's proximate to an Air Force and Army base. Mm-hmm. Would we catch one? You know, because if we did, it wouldn't matter that we won.
I live in San Diego, so
yeah.
I think the entire county is so saturated with military presence here, I think that somebody like China or Russia would probably just saturate the entire county with nuclear just to be on the safe side.
Yeah. Kind of like war games, right? There really is no victory condition.
No. I know you like to do the what is this novel comparable to? What are some similar novels part of your podcast? The two that I came up with, one called War Day by really interesting novel from the 80s by Whitley Strieber and James Konietka. And it basically takes place just a few years after a nuclear war. Interesting in that the main characters of the novel are Whitley Strieber and James Konietka, who are fictional versions of the writers, and they are traveling the United States to see what happened after the nuclear war. And basically what happened is common to another novel that I read with a similar theme is the United States is basically secondary power on the verge of becoming a third world country. You know, in both of these novels, I'm thinking of like England and Japan are like basically recolonizing the United States. War Day in a nice touch. It's always framed as like, you know, we are so, since it's the 1980s, we as a nation in England and Japan are so grateful to the United States for the work you did rebuilding us after World War II that we're going to do the same for you. Aren't we wonderful?
Wow.
Yeah. So that was one. Whitley Strieber went on to write Communion, which he claims to be a memoir of alien abduction.
Oh, right. That's the Christopher Walken movie, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah.
Interesting historically, because War Day, one of the things he has, it's peppered with fake, you know, false newspaper articles and government records, that kind of narrative technique. Mm-hmm. And he does the same thing in Communion, but he claims those things are real.
Right. He was Dan Browning it before Dan Brown.
Pretty much. Yeah. 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 And another one that I really thought was pretty cool was called The World Next Door. No, Sorry, wrong one on my list. Resurrection Day by Brendan Dubois. I don't even know how the heck I stumbled across this one. It's an alternate history novel where the Cuban Missile Crisis turned into an all-out nuclear war. Mm. And it's set in Boston in the 1970s, where the United States is a military dictatorship, kind of resembling the Cold War USSR. And the hero is a reporter for the Boston Globe, and they travel to New York, which has been almost completely evacuated. Of personal note for me, because the narrator, who is a reporter, is an Army veteran who comments that immediately after the nuclear war in the early 60s, he was stationed in San Diego, where he saw the terrible aftermath, including food riots, and he names two towns, La Mesa and Spring Valley. And I'm like, wait, I live in La Mesa. Hold on.
Nice.
And I wrote to the author about it, who's still alive, and he said, I just picked it off a map.
Yeah, yeah. I'll say one that I would point out is Earth Abides, George Stewart. If what you like in this novel, if you've read it, and what you like is the survival part, Earth Abides will, you know, right up your alley. If you prefer the parts of the book that are talking about what leads to the war, then I recommend Red Alert and Failsafe.
Yep.
Red Alert was turned into Dr. Strangelove. Failsafe was turned into Failsafe. But that's an interesting one. We did those ones on Take Me to Your Reader because the novels are so similar that there was a lawsuit.
Yep.
And they turned into two very different movies, both of which are excellent though. So
Yeah. There's a weird one that I like, very, very odd, called Level 7 by a writer named Mordecai Rochwald. Hmm. And there's this idea that there are these people who live in, who are drafted to be in this multi-story underground bunker. And their names are taken away from them, and they're given numbers, and they wear jumpsuits, and they eat manufactured food, and their job is to press the button if there's a nuclear war to launch all the missiles. Mm. Very, very odd book. I also read it about when I was a kid, and it was very enjoyable. If you can call it enjoyable, it's a pretty damn bleak book. Mm. I keep on coming up with more here. There was the Roger Zelazny novel, Damnation Alley.
Yeah. It's a novella.
It's a novella. I think he expanded it out to a novel, and they made it into a movie, which has a reputation for being terrible. There was a supercar in that movie.
Yeah.
You know, an armored kind of supercar that ended up being used in a lot of TV commercials for gas in the 1980s. Yeah. So you kept on seeing this supercar turning up over and over again in movies and in TV commercials.
Yeah. No, the movie is not good, but it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that might about cover it for my list.
Okay. Well, so what would you say to folks, you know, who haven't read this and, you know, do you think this novel is still worth reading for people who are picking it up today?
Absolutely, yes. You know, we're still looking. It's a very entertaining and well-read, well-written, and well-crafted novel. You care about the characters. You care about the setting. You enjoy the writing style. To the extent that it might be dated, it's a period novel. It's like reading a novel written in the 1920s or in Victorian times, where you get a window into a very recent but still different period of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And as far as the message goes, you know, we face our own potential disasters here.
I feel like there's a message in here too that like you can't, you alone are not civilization, right? You have to band together with people, and the community is really at the level where things can come back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this kind of novel or any of the kind of survivalist novels it's interesting to put yourself into the characters and think, how would I fare in this society? How could I be useful? You know, would I have the stuff that was needed to keep things going? Which then you can set that as opposed to something like On the Beach, which is a very different, you put yourself into that. How would you face up to the end?
Yeah.
Now, so, you know, just here at the end, I want to say I think this is a tremendously good novel. The audiobook from Audible, read by Will Patton, is very, very good as well. And I can recommend that. It's not a terribly long novel. So I will say that the ebook version that I've read before has a lot of OCR problems where it must have been scanned in and then used optical character recognition. So you get those weird things where instead of a W, it has three I's or I don't know, all kinds of things like that, where some words are just misspelled and you kind of get used to it, but it is distracting. So if you can get a paperback is the way to go, or Audible.
Yeah, or if you feel adventurous, or you can download the sample. I think there may be a new edition of the ebook out within.
Okay.
You know, I downloaded it in 2020, and when I was looking again, I got the impression that there's a new edition out.
Maybe I'll check that out.
Maybe one other thing, if we haven't bloviated too much, I just thought there was an interesting bit of trivia. There was the TV series Playhouse 90, which was a highly prestigious TV series in the 1950s. It was the TV series, the series that would show the television was not actually just for the uneducated masses, but was for people who went to college could appreciate television too. And
right. They did an adaptation of this, right?
Yeah, they did an adaptation, and a minor role is a young actor named Burt Reynolds. So,
oh wow.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting.
Is it available anywhere? Cause I remember looking it up. At some point.
I didn't see it anywhere. I didn't even see a trailer for it. I did find in my spelunking, I found a description of it that made it sound like it was pretty different, that it really focused on the looting and the pillaging that went on, which was in the novel, but.
Yeah. I mean, in an adaptation, right, you have to decide what to emphasize. And if you decide you want to emphasize the action, that's one way you can go.
Mm-hmm.
Won't necessarily please the people who wanted to focus on the other parts.
Yeah, my impression also of 1950s television is it would have had to have been like a lot of talking heads and a lot of people in rooms. So you can't allow a lot of the stuff is a lot of the action of the novel is basically people discussing what to do and then people doing it, which involves a lot of manual labor.
Yeah.
So, sailing a boat downstream, getting some salt, loading it up into the boats and sailing it back.
Yeah. I think if you want an adaptation of this, you'd have a hard time going wrong with just watching Jericho. It's only two pretty short seasons. It was canceled after essentially one season. And then there was a fan campaign, to bring it back, and they brought it back for, I think, 10 episodes, something like that.
Didn't they bring it back like years later?
No, it wasn't years later. I think it was pretty immediate. It was like one of the early examples of release the Snyder Cut kind of stuff, but a more positive one. I'm making a face.
Like when we finally saw the Snyder Cut, I'm like, wow, this is really a bad movie.
Oh, I enjoyed the Snyder Cut, but that's okay. Well, Mitch, any place people can find you these days?
Well, as you said, I'm pretty active on Facebook. I am a reluctant Facebook addict. You can find me there as Mitch Wagner. It's a public page. So if you just want to follow me there, that's fine. I'm active on Mastodon at MMitchW and Blue Sky at MitchW and also Threads at MitchW and Tumblr. I'm Mitchipedia.tumblr.com.
Wow, Tumblr.
So, yeah. I never left Tumblr. It's still for kids, but they let me sneak on anyway.
Nice. Well, I'll make sure all the links get in there. So.
Yeah,
but I really want to thank you for doing this, Mitch. We'd been talking about doing it for a while, and then I asked if you could move up in the rotation to cover another spot. So I appreciate you being flexible.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Mitch. Talk to you later.
Well, thank you.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Mitch about an interesting book that I've now read a few times, and I enjoy it every time I read it. Hope I've encouraged you to read it if you haven't at this point. But yeah, let me know. This kind of episode, I think I mentioned it on the podcast. I know I mentioned it to Mitch. I just intend these episodes to be a little more informal than the award winners, just because it's a book that I wanted to cover and a book that, you know, my guest wanted to cover for some reason. And we talk about why that is and what we like about the book. As I mentioned in the previous episode, I've kind of gone out of order on some of these things. So I did the zoomed out episode, and then this is more or less a regular episode, but it's one of Seth's picks. And so the next episode, hopefully, will be a regular old episode about an award winner. All right. As always, if you'd like to support the podcast, share the episode with your friends, post on social media. You can sign up at patreon.com/hugospodcast if you want to support the podcast financially. Or you can go to buymeacoffee.com/heaseld and do some non-recurring payments if you want to just throw me a few bucks to buy a book. And I think that's going to do it for this time. So thank you, everybody, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.